Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dear SUV drivers, brace yourselves. Here's the bitter medicine, Detroit's own profile of people who tend to buy SUVs. People who are insecure and vain, who are nervous about their marriages and uncomfortable about parenthood, who lack confidence in their driving skills, and above all, who are self-centered and self-absorbed with little interest in their neighbors or communities. Ouch! And it gets worse. Sport utility vehicles have taken over America's roads. One in every six vehicles sold in the U.S. today is an SUV. Automakers and Madison Avenue tell us they're safer and easier to handle than ordinary cars. But that safe image is an illusion, says Keith Bradshaw. The longtime New York Times Detroit bureau chief looked under the hood of the SUV industry, and what he found was hell on wheels, rollover problems that go far beyond Firestone tires, dizzying statistics about crash survival rates, and a gumbo of sleazy politics that made these gas guzzlers the undisputed kings of the road. Are you ready to hear this? Odds are good you're driving in or along an SUV right now. Do you believe that SUVs are a menace to mankind and women, too? Are you ready to go down fighting for your SUV? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me tonight from Hong Kong is Keith Bradshaw, author of High and Mighty SUVs, The World's Most Dangerous Vehicles and How They Got That Way. Good evening or morning there, and welcome, Keith Bradshaw.
Good morning, in my case. How are you doing?
Just fine.
Beautiful dawn here.
I'm sure. And a long way from Detroit, they've probably had you banished there. We're going to dive into everything you've got to say. It's a damning expose if we buy it. But tell us first, what has the reaction from Detroit been? You were there for 5 years, from 96 to 2001, and you have delivered one mighty wallop against the SUV money pot that Detroit thrives on. What's the response been from Motor City, Keith Bradshaw?
They have been very upset with this book. In fact, a week before the book came out, the auto industry's favorite lobbying and public relations firm, which has its offices a block from the White House, put together a 15-page, unsigned, no-letterhead attack on the book. Among other things, taking quite a few of the quotes out of context and then criticizing the quotes that are out of context. And that then got circulated to auto writers and book reviewers, some of whom just used that instead of actually reading the book. So it has been I've had a variety of problems. But then again, I got a lot of criticism when I was in Detroit for writing about some of the problems of SUVs as well.
Well, I'm sure you did because this style of vehicle, above all others, has been Detroit's savior for the last 10 years. We're going to get into the details, but tell us first, Keith Bradshaw, just how important SUVs have been economically to Detroit and the United States.
SUVs have made a fortune for Detroit automakers and are beginning to make a fortune for other automakers as well. The automakers make almost all of their profits on the SUVs. A mid-size sport utility vehicle often has a profit of $6,000 or $8,000. A full-size SUV has a profit of $10,000 or $15,000. By contrast, on a car, you're really only paying a markup of $1,000 or $2,000 at most. And many cars, the automakers sell at break-even or even at a loss. So the SUVs are important to the automakers' financial health. In turn, they're important to the health of the United States economy in some ways. The GM and Ford are still the two biggest companies in the United States in terms of contributing to the American economy. They are each seven times the size of the Microsoft Corporation. They are each considerably bigger than all of the worldwide operations of all of the American airlines combined. They're each bigger than AT&T plus IBM plus Oracle plus Microsoft. You put together your lists, they remain the cornerstones of the American economy, and they depend very heavily on these SUV profits.
So they are huge, and they're floating on an ocean, a growing ocean of SUVs. What is it about SUVs that makes them so extremely profitable? Why?
SUVs are very profitable for two reasons. One, they're cheap to make. Second, the demand for them has far outstripped the supply. Now, why are they cheap to make? They're cheap to make because most SUVs are still built on pickup truck underbodies. They take the steel rails, what looks like a ladder frame, steel underbody of a pickup truck, and they just lower onto it and bolt on a longer passenger compartment with an extra row or two of seats. It's very cheap to make, and yet they're marking it up to from a $20,000 pickup truck price to $40,000 and even $50,000 for some of the luxury models with a lot of chrome, a little extra sound insulation, and a computer navigation system. The other reason that they're so popular, as I mentioned, is the demand has outstripped the supply. Each year, even the auto industry has been surprised by how much the SUV market has grown. When I moved to Detroit, to my editors at the New York Times said, keep an eye out for if and when the SUV boom might crest. It still hasn't crested. It's extraordinary that we've gone from 1% or 2% of the vehicles sold being SUVs to now about 19% of the vehicles are pickup-based SUVs being sold, and then another 8 or 10% on top of that are car-based SUVs. So
and you
it's
say
a booming segment.
And you say it's going to go on and on and on. One reader, prominent reader of your book, said it was 468 indignant, statistic-rich pages devoted to what you believe is a case of all the car industry's least lovable qualities stuffed into one wretched package, under-engineered, inept, unsafe, polluting, fuel-guzzling, sociopathologically aggressive. We've bandied all this about now, Keith Bretcher. Step up and make the case. Why, in your view, are SUVs such monsters? Americans sure love to drive them.
Americans certainly do love to drive them, but SUVs are bad for safety and they are bad for the environment. Start with safety. As a lot of people know by now, they are three times as likely as a car to kill the other guy in a crash. But it's also important to remember that SUVs are less safe for their own occupants.
How can that be? You're up so high, you've got this huge vehicle around you, it looks like a fortress on wheels.
Exactly. And that look is deliberate. They actually design them that way to look as big and imposing and menacing and often and intimidating as possible. But SUVs are more vulnerable, much more vulnerable in some kinds of crashes. For example, the guardrails in the United States aren't tall enough in many cases to keep an SUV on the road. The posts that hold up the guardrail are often designed in a way that an SUV can get a wheel under the guardrail and hook onto that post, and that'll flip it. If you slide on ice or get sideswiped by another vehicle and start hitting into a guardrail, you're going to be in much worse shape than an SUV, and guardrail-related accidents are 6% of crash deaths in the United States.
But what do the statistics bear out that SUVs are more dangerous? Is the death rate higher in SUVs than in other cars?
Yes. In the most recent year for which the federal government has statistics, for every million registered cars on the road, there were 126 car occupants who died. That is, people actually in the cars.
Okay.
For every 1 million registered SUVs on the road, there were 133 people who died in the SUVs. So they are slightly more dangerous for their own occupants, in addition to greatly increasing the death rate for everybody else.
So, in fact, you've pointed out in the book, Keith, that those numbers are a little misleading because more people in cars are dying because of SUVs. Therefore, it makes the comparison look better than it might be otherwise.
Exactly. I mean, the fact is that SUVs are very vulnerable to single-vehicle crashes. For example, it's not just Explorers that sometimes have problems with the tire-related crashes. The brakes on SUVs aren't as effective as the brakes on cars. They have longer stopping distances. You can't swerve as readily in an SUV. SUVs are more vulnerable to single-vehicle accidents, and they make up the difference, or they make up most of the difference, by killing the other guy in the vehicle-to-vehicle crashes. But the last thing we want for the nation's vehicle fleet are vehicles that are especially vulnerable to single-vehicle crashes and count on killing the other guy. I mean, what you want for a vehicle fleet are vehicles that are safe as possible in single vehicle crashes, that is, they're fairly low and very stable, and they have nice big crumple zones so they don't do too much damage to the other guy and they protect their own occupant in a crash. And that's a description of a full-size car, and I recommend full-size cars very strongly in the book.
So why, Keith Bradshaw, if that's the case, why are Americans flocking to SUVs? And you know they're flocking, and you know they're crazy about them. I mean, it's not a casual thing. It's gone on for a long time now. As you see, the numbers get bigger and bigger. People love these cars, or think they do.
boy, do they ever love them. I mean, Americans have always loved their cars, and it's an emotional attachment. Many people still give names to their cars. SUVs are very popular because they have been very shrewdly designed to cater to a variety of fears and needs in the American public. As far as needs, I mean, they are big and roomy, and regulators intervened repeatedly, changed the rules repeatedly that tilted the playing field against large cars. So the automakers have found it harder and harder to make large cars, so they built SUVs instead.
Now you can take your living room on the road, so maybe that responds to a need for more space. What about the fear factor here?
Well, the fear factor is that automakers have very much tapped into customers' concerns about crime, oddly enough. The crime fears are very strong on SUV drivers. They tend to be people who like, according to the automakers, to be able to, if necessary, run down street gangs or drive out of riot situations. It's a very exaggerated response to concerns about crime or social instability. You particularly find that in Los Angeles, actually.
Do you mean that they actually are thinking to themselves when they buy the thing, I have a repeated need to run down gangs, or they're imagining that they might be confronted with such a situation?
They're imagining they might be confronted with such a situation or with other crime situations. For example, Ford has found that in focus groups, women buyers actually in particular have mentioned that they like the high ground clearance of an SUV because they can more readily see if there's somebody hiding on the other side of the vehicle, behind the vehicle.
Once they get into it?
No, before they get into it. That is, they can look under the vehicle and see if they see a pair of shoes on the
other side. Oh, look under it. I wasn't even thinking of that. Okay.
Yeah, well, I would not have thought of that either, but it comes up a fair bit in the focus groups. You see a lot of catering to crime fears among worried baby boomers in the advertising. For example, the scenes you see of trees bending back from an SUV almost in fear are crime allusions. You see symbols of menace like alligators and so forth, which don't threaten you if you're in the SUV. The SUVs themselves, for example, the Dodge Durango is designed partly to have what looks like almost a savage jungle creature's features, a sort of muscular jaw with the bulging jaw muscles, which are the bulging fenders over the wheels, a very teeth-like grill in the front. All of these features are designed to convey a sense of menace and then also reassurance to the buyer that they are getting something that will help them against crime. The irony, of course, is that traffic accidents are such a bigger risk than crime for Americans. I mean, practically one in 100 Americans is injured each year in a traffic accident. We killed more than 350,000 Americans in traffic accidents just in the 1990s.
And you're saying SUVs crank that up?
SUVs crank it up. Now, mind you, SUVs prevent the death rate from falling. We have made enormous progress in other areas. We've gone from 12% seatbelt usage to 75% seatbelt usage. That's been terrific. We have greatly reduced drunk driving over the last 15 years because of the wonderful work of groups like Mothers Against Drunk Driving. But some of those gains have then been squandered by moving part of the vehicle fleet from cars to SUVs. We've gone from under 2% of the vehicles on the road being SUVs to 10% of registered vehicles now that are SUVs.
Keith Bradshaw,
I
got to break in and just ask you, what motivates you in this? Are you some kind of, do SUVs bother you aesthetically? Do you hate cowboy films? Are you a tree hugger who just grinds his teeth at the sight of a great Detroit product roaring out onto the highway? Do you have some fundamental problem with these cars that comes from your personality?
No, I don't. I'm not a as far as being a tree hugger, I don't think I've ever been active in any environmental groups. Although I certainly do think that we should do what we can to
I mean, it's fine if you do, but we're just trying to get a sense of where you're coming from.
Yeah, no, I just frankly I've always been interested in engineering, although I'm not an engineer, and I do find something that is so clearly inefficiently designed for the uses to which it is being put as something that's not really a satisfying engineering solution.
To say the very least, you must have Detroit engineers hopping mad. We're talking tonight about the SUV juggernaut and how sport utility vehicles conquered America's roads. What's your verdict on the almighty SUV? Do you drive one and love it, or dodge them and hate them? Listeners, you can join the conversation online. Go to our website at onpointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Asprey. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the SUV juggernaut tonight and how sport utility vehicles conquered America's roads. My guest tonight is Keith Bradshaw. He was for 5 years until 2001, New York Times bureau chief in Detroit. He's written a new book. It's a damning expose, if you buy it, of SUVs and all that they've wrought. It's called High and Mighty SUVs, the World's Most Dangerous Vehicles, and How They Got That Way. Why do so many Americans want to drive that burly monster in the sky? And is it time to put the brakes on SUVs, to tighten up regulations and end their free ride? Or is every red-blooded American entitled to life, liberty, liberty, and SUV? You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Keith Bradshaw, I think we've got every SUV driver in America on the lines. Let's invite them in. Jonathan's on the line. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you?
Well, thanks.
I guess first I would like to describe myself as a reluctant SUV driver.
You are a reluctant driver, Jonathan?
Yes, I am.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when I bought my car, which is not a it's not a Detroit, it's a Nissan Pathfinder.
Okay, okay.
I went around and shopped for a full-size car that I thought would suit my needs, and I couldn't find one. I happen to have a large dog, and the major reason why I have an SUV is to accommodate my lifestyle with that dog. And
yep.
It is the easiest thing to do. You throw the dog in the back of the car. He has a whole room to himself. If people get in the car.
Jonathan, I have to break in and ask you, are you calling kind of to defend yourself against that list of characteristics that we reeled off at the top of the show, that Detroit found that SUV drivers are insecure and vain and nervous about their marriage and parenthood and all that? Are you saying,
yeah.
Whoa, not me, I've just got a big dog, dude.
And I'm a very community-conscious person. And so, yeah, I mean, I live in Newton. I see a lot of people drive. I live in Newton, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people drive SUVs that scare the heck out of me. But I also know that there are a lot of other people who it accommodates their lifestyle, who are very community conscious and, you know, try to be environmental as best that they can.
And they also drive that SUV. Jonathan, stand by. I want to put this to Keith Bradshaw. Keith, you've talked with Detroit about how they understand SUV buyers. You must have talked with a lot of SUV drivers as well. Do the driver's self-image and Detroit's understanding of SUV drivers jive?
Often they don't, but Detroit thinks that it knows SUV buyers better than anybody else, and it has put massive sums into the market research for this. Now, in any group of people, you're always going to find examples of all kinds of different kinds of approaches to life. But what the automakers say is that it is more likely that an SUV driver is going to be somebody who is relatively self-centered, somebody who is somewhat less likely to engage in volunteer activities, somebody who is more concerned about their own life and about doing what is best for them, even if it means, for example, even putting other people in danger. They're more likely to do that than people who buy other kinds of vehicles. I have some interesting quotes in the book some people have enjoyed. For example, the market research director at Chrysler told me, quote, "We have a basic resistance in our society to admitting that we are parents and no longer able to go out and find another mate. If you have a sport utility, you can have the smoked windows, put the children in the back, and pretend you're still single."
It's just me, the swinging single up here.
Well, you do get that. Let me ask you
about another, or perhaps the same researcher and marketer at Chrysler that you quote, saying that there's a reptilian instinct that clicks in when we go to buy things as important to our mobility in life as vehicles. And you quote this, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, saying that people are in touch with their inner reptile, and his theory is the reptilian always wins. The reptilian says, if there's a crash, I want the other guy to die. Is it really that dog-eat-dog, that law of the jungle on the car lot when we're buying?
Well, certainly, if you look at an SUV these days, and if you think what it's going to do in a crash to the other guy, then you are making a fairly cynical determination. That's actually from a different researcher, but there is definitely a desire by Detroit to, in the words of one senior executive, build them high and make them husky, unquote, in order to appeal to this sort of dog-eat-dog mentality. Now, that said, what seems to be happening on the American road is something of a highway arms race, in which the SUVs, by being so tall, by having the blinding headlights, by being hard to see around, by looking like something that will come right through your side window or over your bumper, are making people feel more and more nervous about still being in cars. That doesn't mean that the SUVs are safer. What we're seeing here looks almost more like what we saw, for example, with VHS and Beta. It's not that VHS was better. Once enough people were using VHS for their video cassettes, it made more people started using that. It's what we saw with personal computers, with Apple being nearly driven out of business by Microsoft and Windows systems. It's not that those systems were better. It's that when everybody else used them, it became more convenient to use Microsoft and Windows. In the case of SUVs, it's becoming harder and harder to still be somebody in one of the cars, and yet it's not that the SUVs are better. It's that the SUVs are different from cars, and they have some big shortcomings that people are overlooking or don't seem to be aware of in choosing them instead of cars.
When they trade up, but you're saying people in regular cars and sedans increasingly feel like potential roadkill for the SUVs, but it may not be that simple a picture.
Absolutely not. The people in the cars are still have a lower death rate than the people in the SUVs, but the people in the SUVs are putting the cars at risk for the sake of automotive fashion in many cases.
What a world. Jonathan, keep your dog safe in that big SUV. Russ is on the line. Hi, Russ. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you folks?
Well, thanks.
I'm calling safely ensconced in my Honda Accord.
Watch out.
I'm pulled over. Don't worry.
Okay.
You know, I respect quite a lot the observations of the guest. Mm-hmm. Forgive me, I've forgotten your name.
Keith Bradshaw is our guest tonight.
Thank you. I agree, and I guess my comments are essentially to augment some of his ideas. It seems to me like there's a disconnect between what engenders safety and what engenders the idea of safety. And I guess I have the idea that the more people feel unsafe, the more they will operate from their reptile mind.
Mm-hmm.
The more they will choose the things that give them the idea of safety, which may have no connection to those things that actually bring safety.
So you see a kind of psychic extension of an insecure world expressed in SUVs, Russ?
Big time.
Well, big time is exactly the operative word. Thanks for your call. Keith Bradshaw, how about it? Is it possible that in a world of toil and trouble, the SUV becomes a symbol that goes even beyond the driving and transportation experience, that it's a kind of totem against a scary world?
It really is, and that's what they are marketed as. I've heard that in various forms from many market researchers over the more than 5 years that I was in Detroit for the New York Times.
Now, what do you mean they're marketed that way?
Oh, they're marketed that way in the sense of the advertising portraying these as vehicles that can get you safely through all manner of situations, whether it's driving over the rock pile in one of the Jeep ads, driving over the rock pile that has fallen across the entrance to
the supermarket,
the driveway, so the person can get back to his castle, as it were.
Uh-huh.
I mean, as one of the auto industry's favorite market researchers likes to put it, these are vehicles that are the armored cars of the battlefield. They allow you to get safely from your castle to your office with perhaps the security guards. They are symbols of a very insecure country that feels the need to have such big burly vehicles around them. The problem is that these burly vehicles are actually less safe even for their occupants than the cars are.
And as you write, Detroit has spent some $9 billion over the last decade convincing Americans that that safety and that burliness is what they need. Keith Bradshaw, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Gene Jennings, editor-in-chief of Automobile Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Gene Jennings.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, great. Gene, thanks so much for joining us tonight. You know what Detroit's all about, and you pay a lot of attention to cars. I'm looking at a review of yours from April of this year. You're in Scotland, and it's cold, and it's pouring rain, and it's the raging beasts and forest ruts and whipping windshield turns, outcroppings, craggy. And you're thanking the Lord that you've got your Land Rover under you.
I was driving in a river. Did you say that?
Well,
a
river. No, it's all there. And we read it, this kind of lusciously, lovingly described SUV. What's the message here? That hey, driver, you're going to be over your head in a river soon and you need this SUV? Or is this part of the romance and unashamedly so?
You know, this is a kind of funny conversation, first of all, because over 51% of all vehicles purchased now, new vehicles, are sport utility vehicles.
We
and you're all
that.
Kind of hysterical housewives about big, giant, tippy, monster vehicles. But in fact, the SUV category is so diverse. Every type of vehicle that you could possibly want, small, large, sports car, is represented by a quote-unquote SUV. You know, I haven't heard the beginning of your show, and I don't know if you made that point.
I'm glad you've raised it, Gene.
It's so diverse that we at Automobile Magazine are loath to classify vehicles as SUVs. What Keith is talking about, I assume, are big, giant vehicles. And when I say it's kind of a hysterical housewife ranting, I'm imagining all those women who were sure that Audis drove themselves through the garage wall.
Right.
You know, I want Keith to focus on hamburgers because I keep buying them and I'm getting fat. You know, and that's really unhealthy.
Gene, we hear you loud and clear. I want to put just that point to Keith Bradshaw. And I guess, Keith, this is what I was kind of getting at just before the break. You know, here's the response. Is this the Detroit kickback against your expose, that this is a kind of a hysterical housewife response to what's not really a problem or is being grossly exaggerated?
That's silly. And the auto industry, in fact, has been doing a lot over the last several years to try to address the problems. But some of the problems are inherent in SUVs. First of all, in some of the numbers, right now about 19% of the new vehicles sold in this country are pickup-based SUVs. And my book focuses on those. Those are your everything from Ford Explorers up through Ford Excursions or Chevy Suburbans and so forth.
And what percent was that, Keith? I didn't hear the percentage.
About 19% of the new vehicle market.
19 based on a pickup truck chassis.
Okay, then you've got another 9% of the market, which is your crossover utility vehicles. That is, they really are built like a car, but look like a sport utility vehicle from the outside. They tend to be taller than most cars. But the construction under the sheet metal is car-like. And that would be everything from the Lexus RX 300 and Toyota Highlander, both of which are essentially tall Toyota Camrys in many ways, to a Ford Escape, models like that. So it's about 27% of the market. I should add that there's another then 20% or about 18% of the market that is pickup trucks, and then another 8 or 9% of the market that is minivans. So that's how you get up to the 51% of the market that is light trucks that Gene Jennings was referring to. But out of that roughly one quarter of the market that is SUVs, There is a diversity of models, but the still more than two thirds of it are these pickup based models, and I don't think a lot of Americans realize that you cannot drive a traditional pickup based sport utility vehicle the way you drive a car, or particularly a performance car.
Gene
Jennings, talk to us.
Most Americans can't drive and chew gum at the same time. You know, let's address that. And let's also address the issue of Detroit. If Detroit is so smart, how come they're so behind the curve on this whole thing?
What do you mean by that, Gene?
Well, you know, they're not the real hot SUVs, the stuff that, and there have been a couple because Detroit was early on with Explorers, and in fact, they did come out they weren't making enough of them. And not everybody in Detroit was making enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
That is a vehicle that people with large families, and I don't have one dog, I have three dogs. I have a Suburban. I don't even know what I could use with my three giant dogs, but maybe I shouldn't be allowed to have three dogs.
No, she's got to have it, I guess.
You know, I mean, maybe I shouldn't be allowed, and maybe I shouldn't be allowed to live on a one-mile-long dirt driveway. The point is, yeah, people can't drive. They can't drive properly. And there are a handful of vehicles that are not meant to be blasted down the road. And not only large SUVs, but little things like Geo Metros. And cars aren't meant to be driven 95 miles an hour while you're putting on your makeup and talking on your cell phone.
Gene Jennings, we got it. Here's a vote for the SUV that takes your three dogs and gets you down that bumpy drive. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. Gene Jennings is editor-in-chief of Automobile Magazine. Let's get another call. Jack's on the line. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
The reason I'm calling is I'm somewhat of a reluctant SUV driver.
Okay.
As well. We didn't buy one. We kind of inherited one.
Uh-huh.
And, I dislike it because of the low gas mileage, because it's impossible to park.
What do you drive, Jack?
It's a Ford Explorer.
Okay.
Well, half the time. My wife drives it most of the
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
And the one reason I do like that is that I have a feeling that, you know, I live in Boston, that she has a better chance of surviving being hit by an SUV if she's in one.
Okay, let's go straight to that. Keith Bratcher, here's the case, and this is your ratcheting up the arms race in action. Is Jack correct? Is his wife less likely to be seriously injured because she's driving this Ford Explorer?
I get that so often, people buying SUVs just because they think that they need to buy an SUV to protect themselves from the other SUVs out there.
But are they right?
No.
How can they be wrong? You're up high. You're not going to be run over by the bumper of the other SUV. It seems intuitively to be correct.
First of all, SUV to SUV collisions are very deadly.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because neither vehicle has very good crumple zones, and they both are tend to be very heavy vehicles with a lot of energy that's hard to absorb in a collision.
And more rigid.
Heavier vehicles tend to produce rather violent collisions.
Mm-hmm.
But more broadly, what you have to remember is that half of traffic deaths do not even occur in vehicle-to-vehicle collisions.
Mm-hmm.
They occur in single-vehicle collisions. And SUVs are far more dangerous in those collisions, particularly rollovers. Most Americans that I've encountered, and the auto industry agrees that this is true, don't really understand how rollovers happen. More than 90% of rollovers do not happen because somebody is wildly zigzagging down the road the way you see in sometimes the television simulations
movies,
put together
okay.
by trial lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
The way they happen is that the vehicle is tripped, meaning it strikes a curb or a guardrail or a lower-riding vehicle, or maybe it just gets the wheels on one side of the vehicle on the shoulder where there's some soft dirt or gravel. So
and you're saying SUVs are more vulnerable to that?
They are far more vulnerable. They are 60% of the deaths in SUVs are in rollovers compared to 20% of the deaths in cars. And when a rollover happens, it's a very violent event. It's also particularly likely to produce paralysis. Rollovers, although they are rollovers are less than 2% of all traffic crashes because there are so many fender benders out there between vehicles. But rollovers are a quarter of traffic deaths, and they are three-quarters of paralysis.
Mm.
Now, why is paralysis such a problem with rollovers?
Keith Bratcher, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break. Jack, I want to thank you for your call. I'm sorry we're not more reassuring for your wife in the Ford Explorer. We're talking tonight about the SUV juggernaut and how sport utility vehicles have conquered America's roads. Did you know the safety issues when you bought your SUV? Did you learn when an SUV hit you? And is it ethical to drive these gas guzzlers when we might be going to war over oil? Or is it yours and you love it and off we go? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the SUV juggernaut. We're joined tonight by Keith Bratcher. He was New York Times bureau chief in Detroit for 5 recent years. He's out with a new book, a pretty tough expose called High and Mighty SUVs, the World's Most Dangerous Vehicles, and How They Got That Way. Keith Bratcher, we had to interrupt you. You were talking about paralysis and SUV structure. Are you saying there's a greater likelihood of paralysis in an SUV crash? Why?
Because you're more likely to roll over. The taller the vehicle, the more likely it is to roll over in a crash. And it's when you roll over that you run the risk of putting
of
such
paralysis.
A strain on the neck or spine that you get paralysis. You don't get paralysis usually if you're just
hitting another vehicle, and you keep all four wheels on the ground.
We've got it. John's on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Real well, thanks.
Well, I just wanted to call and hopefully give a slightly refreshing view.
Please do.
Not so typical SUV driver. I kind of wanted to break down the stereotype. Unfortunately, it is a very difficult stereotype to fight, just because of all the statistics and just looking around on the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to just basically, I'm 23 years old. I drive a Toyota 4Runner.
Got it.
And actually use this vehicle for what it's been designed for. Snowboard, winter climb.
Right.
But the vehicle actually sees the woods and trails very frequently.
So you've got mud on your fenders, and you're a real-life SUV driver. John, I want to thank you and get back to Keith because our time's running short. But Keith Bretcher, how about it? John needs it. He goes through snow, and he gets into the woods. What percentage of SUV drivers have that profile?
According to the auto industry's research, something like 1% engage in serious off-roading that is actually going down the kinds of trails that you just couldn't tackle in a car at all. But that said, that calls like that are the scariest part of the SUV boom right now.
Why so? Well,
until now, SUVs have been driven mainly by the first big generation of SUV drivers who are middle-aged families. They often have kids, although they don't have large families, interestingly, usually in the case of our SUV buyers. But
okay.
They've been driven by the safest people on the American road. We're beginning to see more and more SUVs being driven by young people in their teens and in their early 20s.
But our caller, John, may be a great driver.
He may be. But as a pattern, the reason why insurance rates are much higher for young people are they do get in crashes more often. And young drivers are particularly likely to make the kinds of mistakes that cause a rollover and can end up with paralysis. What do I mean by that? They are particularly likely to have the inexperience that causes them to hit a curb or to hit a guardrail or to get the wheels on one side on the shoulder.
So we've got a new wave of SUVs that are going to be driven by young people. We haven't even talked about fuel mileage issues. Give us your thumbnail on that, Keith Bradshaw. What's the impact of the SUV explosion?
I covered the OPEC meeting in Osaka, Japan, of the oil ministers from Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and so forth 2 weeks ago. Let me tell you, there are two things in this world that right now they're really excited about among the oil ministers. One is China, because the economy here is booming and they're burning a lot more oil. The other, though, is gasoline consumption in the United States, which is up, up, and away. We've had declining average gas mileage for new vehicles sold in the United States every year since 1988. And the result is we burn more and more gasoline, which means we need to buy more oil from the Iraqis, the Saudi Arabians, and so forth.
And SUVs lead the way. So where does this leave us? Americans love these cars. The world is not getting any more comfy. And if that insecurity is driving purchases, then, as you say, there's going to be more and more on the road. Is there a way to live well with the SUV? I mean, people love to drive them. They want to have them. Can they be made greener, safer, or not?
SUVs can be made greener and safer. The automakers have already started to make some efforts. I wrote a series of stories in 1997 about the dangers of SUVs overriding cars, and the automakers responded by putting these hollow steel bars below and behind the bumpers to catch the bumpers of cars that they hit. But there are still many other things that the automakers haven't done yet. For example, they need to lower the hoods because very high hoods on SUVs greatly increase the risk of death and other serious injury to cars that they hit from the side because
mm-hmm.
that hood comes through the glass and hits
mm-hmm.
you in the head.
Mm-hmm.
The automakers on the environmental side need to keep cleaning up the SUV's emissions. Right now, the SUVs are allowed to pollute 5.5 times as much smog-causing gases per mile as a car.
And can that come down?
That will come down, and by 2009 model year, the SUVs have to meet the same rules as the cars.
Keith Bretcher, you've been a great sport to join us tonight from Hong Kong. We're almost out of time here. I want to thank you for coming on. High and Mighty SUVs, the World's Most Dangerous Vehicles and How They Got That Way is the book. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this SUV conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, Showboat turns 75, and we look at the musical's hit song, Old Man River. This is On Point. Old Man River. 75 years ago tomorrow, the curtain rose on Florence Ziegfeld's Broadway production of Showboat. At the heart of that classical musical of the South is Old Man River, composed by Jerome Kern with lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein. The song pulled up a bittersweet call to freedom in the powerful voice of Paul Robeson, but has been recorded by artists throughout the years, from Bing Crosby to Rod Stewart. In this radio diary, music historian Will Friedwald tells us why Old Man River has endured far beyond its time and context.
The river is itself a character. I mean, it's a story that takes place over multiple generations with this big, wide-ranging cast and all different, you know, cities. It starts in the South, but also goes up to Chicago and to New York, and this, you know, covers this whole thing. And pretty much everything is linked by the river. And the river is sort of this common ground. And Hammerstein realized that it, you know, the show needed a song about the river. And to take it a step further, this song would be used not just as a musical number in you know, Act One, where it's introduced, but it would be reoccurring throughout the show. And again, you know, it would be musically linking all the different scenes much the same way as the river, you know, sort of a parallel to the river. And again, that was something that had never been done in musical comedy before.
I know that old man river.
Well, one of the things that makes Hammerstein so great is that and I think what makes him greater than, say, you know, I don't know, some guy writing protest songs in the 60s is by keeping the subject matter ambiguous enough and by he lends it to, I mean, I think this is the great thing about the American Songbook in general, is that, you know, he can have a message there, but by making it the least bit vague and leaving it open to interpretation, then lots of different people can sing it lots of different ways with lots of different meanings. You know, I don't think that any version of Old Man River can deny that this is a song about freedom, this is a song about, you know, civil rights, this is a song about, you know, expression. And that's inherent in every version, but beyond that, you know, it's a song that's totally open. But the song Old Man River was just an immediate hit. Just, you know, all kinds of bands were covering it and all kinds of singers were doing it from the very, very beginning. One of the best early versions is the famous Paul Whiteman Bing Crosby record. It's probably the earliest version we know of to treat it like a swing song.
Old Man River, that Old Man River, he don't say nothing, but he must know something, because he just keeps rolling. He keeps rolling along, rolling along.
And it works very well, is that, because it has this kind of very primordial ascending and descending melody line that's not all that different from I Got Rhythm, which was written about 3 years later. It's a song that has a lot of possibilities melodically and harmonically for jazz improvisation. And it also is considered part of the black experience, too, which also helped. And, you know, for that reason, a lot of black bands and a lot of, you know, white bands that played swing music were you know, given towards coming out with swing versions of the song. And throughout most of the 20s and 30s, most of the records of Old Man River were, in fact, in swing time. It wasn't until Sinatra came along in the early 1940s and put the song back into its sort of slow, anthemic, original model. You know, he sort of brought it back to the way Paul Robeson did it.
Here we all work along the Mississippi. Here we all work while the white folk play, pulling them boats from the dawn till sunset, getting no rest till the judgment day.
One of the things about this song that Hammerstein was always sort of cagey about, I mean, he was given credit years later for writing what could be described as a social protest song, and he always was very sort of hesitant to take credit for that. However, when you look at the actual text, and you know, you see what the song is saying, you know, there is indeed, I think he eventually would admit that it was, the protest was implied. He called the character he sings a rugged philosopher, in other words, not like a tutored intellectual statement, but, you know, a very sort of basic statement about human nature that comes from, you know, this uneducated character, and that there is this element of protest to the song, which, of course, you know, ironically, by making that statement, it's possible to see, you know, the song completely the other way around. I mean, it's sometimes held up as a song about Uncle Tomming or a song about black subservience, and really that was what Hammerstein was essentially protesting.
Old Man River, that old man river.
There was criticism that Hammerstein was using what we now call the N-word, and it is the first word of the song.
there was some controversy over it, when especially in terms of the London production, which is the one that starred Paul Robeson, because he was not in the original Broadway production. On Broadway, the role of Joe was played by Jules Bledsoe, and finally in London he got to do it a few months later. And at that time, Robeson was already being regarded as sort of an Afro-American role model, and the black American press, which actually did have a reporter in London apparently, was complaining that he was using this very a word that was very offensive even then, and using it quite a lot in the show. Very early on, even by the 30s, they were getting rid of that word.
From Hollywood, we present the Stan Freberg Show.
In the 1950s, Stan Freberg did a parody of Old Man River, which he called Elderly Man River, on his radio show. And the idea in this presentation was that Freberg was trying to sing the song, and that he keeps being interrupted by the censor, and the censor keeps informing him as to which words and phrases he finds objectionable, but at no point does he ever raise any hackles about, the whole political aspect of the song.
Old Man River, that old...
All right, Tweedley, politeness I dig, but what in the world is wrong with Old Man River?
The word old has a connotation some of the more elderly people find distasteful. I would suggest you make the substitution, please.
I suppose you insist?
Precisely.
Elderly man river, that elderly man river, he must know something, but he don't say nothing.
All right, hold it, fellas. Now what, Tweedley?
The word something, you left off the G.
And he kind of, sweats all the small stuff where he completely ignores, the big point of the song and whether that's offensive or not. It's a very funny parody treatment of sort of the whole history of Old Man River.
There's an old man called Mississippi.
Well, the song still is about, conditions of the human race that have not been fully resolved, and it still goes straight to the heart of, the matter, and the fact that Hammerstein wrote it in such a way that it wasn't about just like one little issue or even about one people or another people, but it was really about the whole deal. And it could be applied to almost anything. It could be applied to any situation anywhere in the world. Even in sort of a shortened, truncated verse where he talks about how the river doesn't care if the land ain't free. The river is just indifferent. It goes on no matter what. And, the river's been flowing for 75 years now and then doesn't show any signs of stopping.
Just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along.
Wilfried Wald is a writer living in New York City. He's the author of Stardust Melodies.
He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, and them that plants them is soon forgotten. But Old Man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that rod, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and your land's in chains.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Darren Manoogian and Todd Brubaker. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is